Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 10th of December 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at radioalbion.com. As if you couldn't have worked out by the noise of my new chair, which I would have edited it out otherwise, but we are here live tonight to get into our Patriotic History program talking about the history of mail. And we do have with us tonight my co-host, the Patriarch. Patriarch, how are you doing? What's life like for you?
How are we doing? Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Life's okay, preparing for Christmas, and I guess it's starting to slow down a bit. Hopefully slow down a bit, but just some last things to do, bits of work to get out of the way, and should be ready to enjoy and spend time with family and that, you know.
Excellent stuff. I've had a few days off this week, so this is really my first live show in a week, so I'm okay. Feeling a little bit rusty, and I do have a new chair, so I do apologize if there is squeaking noises. I'm just getting used to it, and we will be pre-recording some episodes of Patriotic History as well, so you'll be able to have a nice relaxing rest of the month. So we won't be actually doing any more live shows this month, but we do have some exciting content for you listeners out there. In the last episode, we got talking about the origins of the postal system, and we thought this episode it would be interesting to take a detour into that at the beginning. We also have some information on the pale-skinned Japanese called the Ainu that we're going to try to fit into this episode as well. And then after that, we will move back onto the dolmens and the megaliths that also link white people to Asia. And I thought this would be, look, when I started looking into this, I thought this is really interesting, because I think you brought this up, didn't you, Patriarch, about mail and the history of that and how did it come about?
Yeah, I think I had some questions. Yeah, I was curious about how things worked back then. I think one of the points we made was that it was possibly something reserved for people a bit more affluent, but I wasn't sure on that.
Well, yes, originally, but I think also citizens were able to make use of it as well. And it's something that was pretty much unique to white people at first.
Okay.
The practice of communication by written documents carried by an intermediary from one person or place to another almost certainly dates back nearly to the invention of writing. However, the development of formal postal systems occurred much later. The first documented use of an organized courier service for the dissemination of written documents is in Egypt, where pharaohs used couriers for the dissemination of their decrees in the territory of the state in 2400 BC, and the earliest surviving piece of mail is also Egyptian, dating to 255 BC. And we pointed out before that the actual first evidence for a mail system was in Mesopotamia, and they were sending out clay tablets, and they also had covers for the clay tablets as well, so people couldn't see what was actually written on them. And we find the evidence of these covers. I think they're called bullae, something similar to that. So we know they did have this postal system. It's just we don't have many details on it, but we do have details of this system for the pharaohs, and it was important for them so that they could get a message out of what their laws were and what they wanted people to be doing. So and that would be carried by, I guess, on papyrus. But I was talking about this with my parents and tying it in with music and singing. And my mother was telling me that originally this is what the town crier used to do. And the town crier would go out into London, and he would sing whatever the news was and whatever the king's decree was. And then other people would remember the rhyme. They would remember the tune because they weren't actually able to read, and they would sing this tune. And that's how the information, that's how the news would actually get around, was through people singing, which I thought was quite interesting. And that's obviously where this origin of the town crier comes from, where he rings his bell and he, gives out this information. And what we had here is for the people that could actually read, they could have mail sent about, but not everybody can read. So that's where song used to come from.
I wonder if technology had a role to play in terms of, you know, being able to perpetuate, for example, like the invention of Papirius. You know, it was it lent to being able to carry more and you know, more writing things down easier, I guess, and recording things easier. I just wonder if that may have influenced it.
Well, that would have made life easier, wouldn't it? Because you could carry more mail than if it was clay tablets, but the clay tablets themselves were more durable, less likely to get damaged. So there's a payoff between the two, I guess. But do you think this is we've had mail for 4,000 years, 5,000 years? We've been able to get messages from one end of the country to another, from one end of the empire to another. And if you have an empire, if you have lots of countries together that you're ruling over, you need to be able to get your message to the furthest reaches of the empire. And it needs to get there exactly as you have intended it to be heard as well. So if you have an empire, you've got to have a mail system or a courier system, at least, I would have thought.
Yeah, do you know if there's any truth to the whole sending out ravens with the mails, with the, you know, like messages and things? That's a kind of mail system, right? But I mean, that was in Game of Thrones, but I don't know if there's any kind of truth to that, or it's just a fantasy.
You always hit me with these great questions that I'm not expecting. I know they had homing pigeons, and they had homing pigeons from a long time back, probably Roman times, but I'm not sure if they would have used ravens. I would have to look into that. And I am remiss for not actually putting down a bit to do with the homing pigeons, because that, I think that was a very clever idea, because that's obviously very fast, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot faster. Maybe it's higher risk, I don't know. It depends to the extent of how well they were trained. But it's interesting.
You'd have to take your pigeon with you, and he would have to know, and he'd only be able to take the mail back to one particular place. If you have a courier on horseback, then they can deliver it to different places.
I think that was more important for you know, really urgent messages, especially during war. You know, like if some, say, if one of the commander had died or something, they needed to get word across the battlefield really fast, or, you know, further away.
I think the Romans were using carrier pigeons, homing pigeons, but we'll have to check that one out. The first credible claim for the development of a real postal system comes from ancient Persia, and the best documented claim as well, which is from Xenophon, attributes the invention to the Persian king Cyrus the Great. And I think you can also pronounce that Chris, because they didn't have the S for a C. They had like a K sound, so that would have actually been Chris the Great. So it's the same as the name that we have today, Chris. In 550 BC, and he mandated that every province in his kingdom would organize reception and delivery of post to each of its citizens. So it wasn't just for the rich. And this Cyrus the Great, or Cyrus, or Chris the Great, that's the one that freed the Israelites, I think, or maybe the one after Darius. It was the one after, I think.
The Babylonian king.
I mean, he was important.
Cyrus the Great. Well, when was the deportation to Babylon? Because it was only 70 years they were there for, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it must have been.
So it might have been Cyrus.
Must have been around about this time, because there's also Darius the Great as well, who put up the that carving on the Behistun Rock, which was of the Israelites. So it was around this time. I mean, this was a big empire. They were very, very, very powerful people. And they set up this postal system. And it wasn't just for the rich and powerful. It was also for the citizens. And he also negotiated with neighboring countries to do the same. And he had roads built from the center of post in western Iran all the way up to the city of Hakka in the east. Other writers credit his successor Darius I of Persia with doing this, which was 521 BC. Some sources claim much earlier dates for an Assyrian postal system, with the credit being given to Hammurabi in 1700 BC and Sargon in 7022 BC. So they're all very famous characters, that we've mentioned at one point or another. Yeah. Hammurabi was the one that came out with the law codes. Sargon the first we talked about, wasn't it? That and his beginning of his empire in Mesopotamia. This Sargon the second, I think he was one of the ones that was involved with the Israelite deportations. I think he took the northern house of Israel, and he was Assyrian, and then it was the Persian one, the Babylonian one, that took the tribe of Judah.
Right. Yeah, I've literally finished reading the book of Isaiah for the first time, actually. And there's a verse which really stuck out to me. And it pretty much said, obviously, they were being punished, and that was their punishment, to be kind of dispersed or, captured and taken captive by the Assyrians. But they were also kind of prophesied to spread the tentacles basically as far as they can to the left and to the right. And it says to basically, to almost swallow up the Gentile nations, which would have been, the white nations and any whites that were there already. So, that's quite a telling prophecy, really, of what exactly happened.
Well, as we discussed it a couple of weeks back, didn't we? The Scythians that went to the east and the Scythians that went to the west. And that's who they were. And they became the Saxons when they went to the west, and the Scythians when they went into the east and into India. And we'll hear more about them today as well. So I think that's referring to that, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's just mind-blowing how, these blatant scriptures are there and they're just overlooked by just the mainstream. It's like, well, this is spoken as if it's prophetic. How could Israel be anything other than what came to fruition, rather than a people that had kind of stayed in place there, and yes,
it doesn't make sense, does it, that it's the Jews? If it's the Jews, then all the prophecies remain unfulfilled. If it's white people, then all the prophecies have been fulfilled, and that's
pretty much
they miss.
Stronger case, that's for sure.
May or may not have been the primary mission of this postal service, however. The role of the system as an intelligence gathering apparatus is also well documented, with the service later being called Angiriae, a term that in time came to indicate a tax system. And the Old Testament book of Esther makes mention of this system, with Ahasuerus, the king of the Medes, using couriers for communicating his decisions. And in the book of Esther, the king makes a decree, and that gets sent out to all his subjects. So that tells us that there was this system there where the couriers could go out and read out what was what the king wanted, basically. So I think that ties in with the town crier thing, where they would read out whatever it was that the king said, and it would be read out with a melody to aid people to actually remember it. And then they would sing back the memory, and that news would get passed on around the kingdom. So we've got this mention of it there with the book of Esther. Obviously, as far as the book of Esther is concerned, there's another version of the book of Esther that's in Flavius Josephus' works, which would seem to be far more in keeping with the rest of the Bible. And the version of the book of Esther that we actually have in the Bible seems to be not in keeping with the rest of the Bible.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think it was tampered with then?
Well, I think it could possibly be the wrong version that was actually put in the Bible.
Right.
Basically. I mean, I haven't looked at it recently, but it's the only book in the Bible not to mention God. And it talks about the Jews in it, and the moral of the story is different in the version that's Flavius Josephus's version, which was obviously the version that was around at the time of Christ. There are some people that think that the Book of Esther just it has no business actually being in the Bible in the first place, but it's a quandary to work out quite what to make of it, to be honest.
So the main, was it a similar story, just slight changes and lack of the mention of God?
Yeah, there's a different moral to it. When you look at the story of Esther that's in the Bible, there doesn't really appear to be a moral there, and it appears that this group of people that are called the Jews are breaking the rules of the Israelites, because they're marrying other peoples rather than marrying the Israelites for a start. And it seems to be saying that it's not encouraging good behavior, basically. Bad behavior gets rewarded, whereas in the Flavius Josephus version, good behavior gets rewarded. I think that's the best way to put it.
Right, okay.
But I would have to look into it again.
She marries the king, right?
Yeah, and that's not, you know, it says in the Old Testament that they're only to marry their own people. If they marry somebody else, then the covenant doesn't the covenant's broken, because the covenant was with the descendants of Jacob Israel. It wasn't with the descendants of anyone else. And that's why it says, thou shalt not give thy daughter to the sons of a strange god. Mm. So to have Esther marrying the king Ahasuerus, the king of the Medes, although he was white, he wasn't one of the Israelite peoples.
And so in the other version, who does she marry, or does she even marry?
I can't recall. I mean, it may even be that it breaks that rule in that as well, but it does have much more of a morality to the actual story itself. I'm going to have to have a read of it again, Patriarch, because it's been a long time since I looked into
it. Maybe we can update it on the next podcast.
Yeah, I mean, the point in bringing it up here is because it confirms that there was this male system that was in operation. And this is mm-hmm. And we've been saying since the beginning that you can use the Bible as an aid to history. The history that it talks about in the Bible is accurate, unless there's been some kind of a mistranslation, which occasionally you do get. But it's an accurate record of the history, because it was written at the time. It's a primary source document. Mm-hmm. Well, this Persian system worked using stations called chapakhana, where the messenger carrier, called the chapa, would ride to the next post, whereupon he would swap his horse for a fresh one with maximum performance and delivery speed. And Herodotus described the system in this way. It is said that as many days as there are in the whole journey, so many are the men and horses that stand along the road, each horse and man at the interval of a day's journey, and these are stayed neither by snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor darkness, from accomplishing their appointed course with all speed. And this verse prominently features on New York's James Farley Post Office, although it uses a slightly different translation. Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. So they had a good system there, and what they were thinking about is speed, basically. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much of an intelligence network, because if you're going to have an intelligence network, which is what the Romans tried to do later on, they worked out that it was better to have one man carrying the mail, so that one man could then report on what he saw when he brought the mail to wherever he was going. So it was used for intelligence gathering, whereas if you've got lots of different men that are carrying the post along, they can go a lot quicker, because they're not going to get tired out, and they can, you know, one man can be riding at night while the other one's getting his sleep. But you wouldn't then be able to get such a good relay of the information from that person who was delivering the mail, because it wouldn't have been him that had travelled right the way through the country to actually get to you with the mail. So the Romans did it in a different way.
It's like passing a baton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was the way that the Persians did it.
There must have been a high trust network, though, right? I mean,
it must have been. There's no mention of them getting robbed or anything like that. I mean, the king's highway, you were guaranteed not to be accosted if you were on the king's highway. It was an important thing. It was the measure of being a king was whether you had peace within your kingdom and people could travel along the highway without being attacked. And if they were attacked, it was a very, very, very serious crime, because that was the king's highway that people were travelling on. And you needed to get permission as well to travel along it if you were from outside the country as well.
Right.
We're moving on from Persia to India. And we have another postal system there. The economic growth and political stability under the Mauryan Empire, 322 to 185 BC, stimulated sustained development of civil infrastructure in ancient India. The Mauryans developed early Indian mail service, as well as public wells, rest houses, and other facilities for the public. Common chariots called Dagna were sometimes used as mail chariots, and couriers were used militarily by kings and local rulers to deliver information through runners and other carriers. The postmaster, who was also the head of the intelligence service, was responsible for ensuring the maintenance of the courier system, and couriers were also used to deliver personal letters. So this is just after Alexander the Great, and he fought against these people, and we were wondering whether they were white or whether they were non-white, and this clears it up, I think, because the Mauryan Empire, I think, were clearly white because they followed a strict caste system, and the Vishnu Purana was likely written at this time. They also defeated Alexander the Great's satraps after his death and formed the Indo-Greek Kingdom, which is now Afghanistan, Pakistan, and northern India. That's what it's called now. And that's why we find Greek texts in that area, and that's why we find Buddhist texts in the Greek area. So you had this Indo-Greek Kingdom, and we know that Alexander the Great's people were there. They were all white as well. Again, this is where this white DNA came from that we still see traces of that were there. And
so was it part of the Byzantine Empire then, but like a fraction of it?
Well, this was the Mauryans. This was one of the great empires of India, basically, this Mauryan Empire. It was fairly important. One of their greatest kings came from it, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But they followed the Vedas originally, and then they became Buddhist. And the Rig Veda is one of the primary texts that the Mauryans originally followed before they became Buddhist after being conquered by the Scythians. And these religious texts contain clear racial references. I've got one here from the Rig Veda, 973.5. Over sire and mother, they have roared in unison bright with the verse of praise, burning up rightless men, blowing away with supernatural might from earth and from the heavens the swarthy skin which Indra hates. So they're basically saying that people with dark skin, they don't have rights, they don't have religion, and the god Indra hates them, and they need to be blown away with supernatural might from the earth and the heavens. There's another one from the Rig Veda, 941.1. Active and bright have they come forth, impetuous in speed like bulls, driving the black skin far away. So again, that's another reference to the skin colour there. Rig Veda 220.6. Indra, the slayer of Vritra, the destroyer of cities, has scattered the Dasyu, sprang from a black womb. And I think that's what they called these people that were black, the Dasyas, the Dravidians, I think they call them now.
Oh, yeah. I've heard the term Dravidian. It's a specific race, isn't it?
Yeah, they're the very dark-skinned, negroid type from southern India, basically.
Yeah, although the phenotype is quite different. The features are almost white-looking, but they're kind of really dark-skinned, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of the ones that look more like Australian Aborigines.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're very, very, very dark. I should imagine that there's been blending between them and the more Aryan types, which result in the type that you're referring to with Caucasian features, but with dark skin.
Yeah, but I'm obviously thinking of the modern day versions.
Yeah.
So.
And then there's another one, Rig Veda Mandala 10, hymn 96. Thou, when praised by men who sacrificed of old, hadst pleasure in their lords, O Indra, the golden-haired, all that befits thy song of praise, thy welcomest, the perfect pleasant gift, O golden-hued from birth. So you see that the god there is depicted with golden hair, and their enemies are depicted as black and as having sprung from a black womb. So they were clearly aware of the differences between the races, I would say.
Yeah, you can't really... it's quite black and white, excuse the pun, but it's literally just laid out, plain text, really, how they saw the different races and peoples and their attitude towards them. I just wonder if these scripts now that you're reciting, if they're still kind of recited by modern day Indians.
They try to claim that there should be like a different translation. I think there is argument over it. There is argument over it. But these were translated by Germans, I think, were the ones who originally translate them. When they discovered that there was a link between Sanskrit and the European languages and Persian. In Indo-European. Mm. And Sanskrit is apparently a very, very rich language, and it's one of the earliest ones.
Yeah, there's another language, I forget what it's called now, Vidra or something like that. It's one of the earlier forms. It's linked to runes as well.
Yeah, the actual writing is it looks quite different to me to the runes.
Trying to remember what it would be. I might have a look through some history in my feeds, but there's definitely a language which I was quite surprised by, but it might even I don't know if it would be before Phoenician, but it could be.
Well, we're going to get on to the Phoenicians in a week or two's time as well. I've got quite a bit of information on them. But also here, I mean, they had a strict caste system as well, and if you find somewhere that has a caste system, then they know about race, don't they? The actual word for caste, it means colour. I forget what it is. Yeah. It begins with V, the Indian word for it, but it actually means colour. So it's like a colour grade. And they had the untouchables were the ones with the darkest skin, and the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, the warrior caste and the priestly caste, they were white.
Well, to a certain extent, they still have a kind of caste system now, don't they? I mean, if you was to look at Bollywood as an example, they take the most fair-skinned people.
Hindus still have a caste.
And herald them as the most kind of more attractive and successful. So to a certain extent, they are glorifying that caste system with what remains of, with that tradition.
Well, they try to get rid of it with Bollywood. I mean, I've seen movies where I forget what it's called, Bandit Queen or something like that, and there's one of the lowest caste women, and she's mistreated by the people in her village, and she gets her revenge and massacres them all. And the message is that everybody is all equal, democracy should be promoted.
Oh, right.
So they do push that because they do still have the caste system in India. They still have the untouchables that are to do all the work that that the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas aren't supposed to do, and they're like washing in the river, cleaning up. They have separate entrances, separate places where they can go, and they're just classed as untouchable, and they're born that way. And we might look at that and say, well, that's really unfair. Somebody's got to do the dirty jobs. And that was the way their system evolved, was that this group of people here will do the dirty jobs. This group of people here will do the more intelligent jobs. This group of here will do the fighting. And when you think about it, when what we know about heredity, that's really the best way to have it, because you've got the most intelligent people breeding together, going to produce more intelligent people. You've got the strongest, fittest warriors breeding together. They're going to breed people that are strong and fit and ready to fight. And then you've got people that are going to be happy without having too much to tax the mind, that are going to be happy doing a menial job, that don't have such a high IQ. And that's going to be the other group. And they're all required in order for society to function. So it's just the way that they developed their system. And then when the Muslims went over there and took over, they messed up the caste system. They just they messed it all up. That's what actually really caused the blending of the peoples over there is when Islam took over. Because in Islam, all the races are, all the races are the same. You can marry your slave girl. You can have sex with your slave girl. Whereas with the Hindu religion, you've got the castes, and with the Israelite religion, again, it was all about what your ancestry was, and you had to prove who your ancestors were. It's the same with Druidry. You had to show that you were a free man for 10 generations before you become a Druid. And I think with the Nordic Germanic religions, they had a caste system as well. In fact, there's a book I read, the Book of the Danes, and it makes it clear in that there was a caste system. So it's really Islam that overturned all of that and said that everybody is all the same. We're all one race. Once you've become a Muslim, you can breed with other races.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of people say that it was created really as to be a thorn in the side of Christianity. Because if you think when Christianity came about, at least in its beginnings, when obviously there was a more of a racial undertone to it, then you know it was bringing and uniting the whites of the world at that time, wasn't it? And so in order to gain dominance over them, they say that Islam was potentially created to go against it and to do the opposite, to undermine it.
Well, it did unite the Arab tribes, and it was seen as being a Christian heresy at first. It was seen as a Christian heresy that was more to do with the Jews than anything else. Because Muhammad's mother, I think, was Jewish. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson recently did a podcast on that, about how it was seen as an early Christian heresy at first. That's a couple of weeks ago on the Orthodox Nationalist. Getting back to here, we'll have a look at this famous king of this Mauryan Empire. His name was Ashoka, and he was their most famous king, probably the most famous king in all of India. And he embraced the teachings of Buddhism and renounced war and violence. And obviously this was after fighting with the Scythians. Ashoka implemented principles of ahimsa, which is non-violence, by banning hunting and violent sports activity, and by ending indentured and forced labour, because they had a lot of slaves there at the time, because many thousands of people in war-ravaged Kalinga had been forced into hard labour and servitude. While he maintained a large and powerful army, to keep the peace and to maintain authority, Ashoka expanded friendly relations with states all across Asia and Europe, and he sponsored Buddhist missions. He undertook a massive public works building campaign across the country, and over 40 years of peace, harmony and prosperity made Ashoka one of the most successful and most famous monarchs in all of India's history, and he remains an idealized figure of inspiration in modern India today. So he's the Indian equivalent of Alfred the Great,
okay,
I guess, or Edward Longshanks. And the edicts of Ashoka, set in stone, are found throughout the subcontinent. So he propounded his own laws as well, ranging from as far west as Afghanistan and as far south as Andhra or Nellore district. Ashoka's edicts state his policies and his accomplishments. Although predominantly written in Prakrit, two of them were written in Greek and one in both Greek and Aramaic. Ashoka's edicts refer to the Greeks, the Cambodjas, and the Gandharas as the people forming a frontier region of his empire. They also attest to Ashoka having sent envoys to the Greek rulers in the west, as far away as the Mediterranean. The edicts precisely name each of the rulers of the Hellenic world at the time, such as Antiochus, Tulimaya, Ptolemy, Amtikini, Antigonus, Macha, Magus, and Alexandra, as recipients of Ashoka's proselytism. And the edicts also accurately locate their territory 600 yojanas away, with a yojana being about 7 miles, which corresponds to the distance between the centre of India and Greece. roughly 4,000 miles. So he was quite an interesting character, this Ashoka. And I guess what must have been, well, I don't know how many years after that Islam actually went there and took over, but this was a period in India when it was multicultural, but you had whites there, the same as places like Egypt was multicultural, but you had whites running it. And Alexander and his aristocracy were running the establishment in Egypt for a few hundred years after Alexander had actually conquered it.
Okay, that's interesting. So this guy kind of took the helm in a way.
Yeah, and he set up a mail system again, and you have to have a mail system if you have a big empire. And he had Afghanistan, Pakistan, and North India. And I think I'm sure that there were universities there, and it was like a sort of a bit of a golden age, the 40 years when they had the King Ashoka, and that was the Mauryan Empire. And again, this is because there was a postal system of note there, basically. And it's another white one. Next, we'll have a look at Rome and Rome's postal system. The cursus publicus, which is Latin for the public way, was the state-mandated and supervised courier and transportation service of the Roman Empire, later inherited by the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire. It was a system based on obligations placed on private persons by the Roman state. As contractors called mancipes, they provided the equipment, the animals, and the wagons. In the early empire, compensation had to be paid, but this had fallen into abeyance in late antiquity when maintenance was charged to the inhabitants along the routes. So it was paid for by tax, basically, later on. The service contained only those personnel necessary for administration and operation, and these included veterinarians, wagon wrights, and grooms. I find that interesting. Like today, you have engineers and an MOT and the garage, and back then you had veterinarians and wagon wrights and grooms. So animal power. The couriers and wagon drivers did not belong to the service, whether public servants or private individuals. They used facilities that were requisitioned from local individuals and communities. And the costs in late antiquity were charged to the provincials as part of the provincial tax obligations in the form of a liturgy or munus on private individual taxpayers. So that was all paid for by tax rather than individuals paying for what was being sent to them. The Emperor Augustus created it to transport messages, officials, and tax revenues between the provinces and Italy. The service was still fully functioning in the first half of the 6th century in the Eastern Empire when the historian Procopius accused Emperor Justinian of dismantling most of its sections, except for the route leading to the Persian border. So the destruction of the Great Western Railway was not the first time that the establishment had destroyed a communications network. So quite clearly, this a similar thing had happened here. Justinian dismantled it. The extent of the cursus publicus is shown in the Tabula Peutingeriana, a map of the Roman road network dating from around AD 400. And it was set out by a series of forts and stations that were spread out along the major road systems connecting all the regions of the Roman world. The relay points, or change stations, provided horses to dispatch riders and usually soldiers, as well as vehicles for magistrates or officers of the court. The vehicles were called clabulae, but little is known of them. A diploma or certificate issued by the emperor himself was necessary to use the services supplied by the cursus publicus. Abuses of the system existed, for governors and minor appointees used the diplomata to give themselves and their families free transport. Forgeries and stolen diplomata were also used. Pliny the Elder and Trajan write about the necessity of those who wish to send things via the imperial post to keep up-to-date licenses. So that seems like it was more like a sort of railway, public railway, a way that people could get about for free, travelling with the mail wagon sort of thing.
It's like a next level, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the Romans adapted their state post from the ancient Persian network of the royal mounted couriers called the Angarium. As Herodotus reports, the Persians had a remarkably efficient means of transmitting messages important to the functioning of the kingdom called the Royal Road. The riders would be stationed at a day's ride along the road, and the letters would be handed from one courier to another as they made a journey of a day's length, which allowed the messages to travel pretty fast. Augustus at first followed the Persian method of having mail handed from one courier to the next, but he soon switched to a system by which one man on his own made the entire journey with the parcel. Although it is possible that a courier service existed for a time under the Roman Republic, the clearest reference by Suetonius states that Augustus created the system to enable what was going on in each of the provinces to be reported and known more speedily to him. He at first stationed young men at short intervals along the military roads and afterwards post chaises. The latter seemed the more convenient arrangement, since the same men who bring the dispatches from any place could, if occasion demanded, be questioned as well. So this is why he would just have one person doing it. Rather than speed, he wanted to be told what was happening throughout the provinces. Tacitus says that couriers from Judea and Syria brought news to Vitellius that the legions of the East had sworn allegiance to him, and this also shows that the relay system was displaced by a system in which the original messenger made the entire journey. Augustus modified the Persian system, as Suetonius notes, because a courier who travels the whole distance could be interrogated by the emperor upon arrival to receive additional information to the package orally. That may have had the additional advantage of adding security to the post, as one man had the responsibility to answer for the successful delivery of the message. That does not come without a cost, though, as the Romans could not relay a message as quickly as they could if it had been passed from one rider to the next. So different ways of doing it with different priorities, which I guess you can really sort of tell how peaceful the empire was, because the Roman emperors are not really trusting what's going on, and they want somebody to be feeding this information back to them, whereas the earlier empires, the Persians, they're quite safe to rule. They don't need to have that. They just want to get the mail there as quickly as possible.
Definitely different cultural values as well. Maybe it's also down to the ruler, you know, his personality helps to shape things. If he's just generally more untrusting, I don't know.
Yeah, suspicious of his subjects. I think the Roman emperors, they didn't really have a right to rule, did they? They weren't descended. They tried to marry into royal families, but they weren't royal themselves. And all of those main ones there were white. But China also had a male system, and that was supposedly started by the Han Dynasty of 206 BC to 220 AD. Which, I mean, this Han Dynasty, I mean, they could have been white around about that time, because we were talking about it before, weren't we? The Buddhists and those monks that were around at that time, they were said to have red hair and blue eyes.
Yeah, what year was that? It was
that was about that time, I think.
Yeah,
it was about that time when Buddhism was brought to them, because it was the father of Buddhism in China was definitely white.
And that was one of the points we made before, is the samurai.
Yeah.
It was about 500 AD, I think, that they came about, and it was kind of just towards the tether end of when Buddhism started to come in, I think. So there would have been some overlap for sure. So I think it would have been around then.
Because we also have the first evidence of the Mongolian body type, or the Han Chinese type. The first evidence of that is from about that time, from about 200 BC, from on the Pamir Plateau, with those with the mummies of Urumqi. Remember when we were talking about the museum that they had there, and it the earliest mummies were all white, and then when you get to the end of the display, it shows you the most recent bodies that they found, and that's the first time that they actually come across any Han Chinese. I forget exactly the date of it, come to think of it. I mean, it may have been 500 BC rather than 200 BC, and the earliest ones were from 2000 BC to 1500 BC. And they were the Caucasian ones, definitely Caucasian. So China had a male system, but nothing really remarkable, unlike these ones. Moving on to Japan and a different subject, the Ainu, and I've been told here that it sounds like Ainu in the chat, the Ainu were once suspected of being a remnant of one of the original white tribes to make it to that part of the world. And that could be so. That could be so. We'll have a look at the evidence for that. They exhibit a variety of phenotypes ranging from Caucasian to East Asian. So they do look Caucasian, some of them at least, with most having an intermediate appearance, Eurasian. And many Ainu men have abundant wavy hair and often have long beards. And if you look on Wikipedia, you can see they do look very European. Their hair does look European. And their facial features, some of them. The Book of Ainu Life and Legends by the author Kiyosuke Kindaichi, published by the Japanese Tourist Board in 1942, contains a physical description of Ainu. It says, many have wavy hair, but some straight black hair. Very few of them have wavy brownish hair. Their skins are generally reported to be light brown, but this is due to the fact that they labour on the sea and in briny winds all day. Old people who have long desisted from their outdoor work are often found to be as white as Western men. The Ainu have broad faces, beetling eyebrows, and sometimes large sunken eyes, which are generally horizontal and of the so-called European type. Eyes of the Mongolian type are rare, but occasionally found among them. So that seems to be describing like a clime, doesn't it? A mixed group that was originally two different races that have blended together to make the people group that is there now.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, just looking at Wikipedia now, it says the regions with significant populations would be Japan and Russia. So I don't know if they are kind of somewhere in between of Russia and Japan.
Well, a craniometric study by Brace et al. 2001 showed a closer morphological relation of Hokkaido-Jomon samples with Europeans. The study concludes that at least the Hokkaido-Jomon people are mostly descendants of a population dubbed Eurasians by Brace et al. That moved into northern Eurasia and also the Americas in the late Pleistocene, which significantly predates the expansion of the modern core population of East Asia from mainland Southeast Asia, including the major lineage of the Jomon people of Honshu. So that appears to be saying, well, we have found a close, very, very close to Europeans, so we have to think up an excuse for this. So we'll say that it must have come there in the late Pleistocene rather than in the last few thousand years. Because that's what they would do, because they would say, they can't possibly have been there a few thousand years ago. Europeans were just in Europe living in caves in the Stone Age, freezing their butts off in the cold. So we can't have that.
Yeah, there was, I was having a little debate on one of these Telegram channels. I was arguing, using a lot of the haplogroup science as a vehicle for interpreting scripture, really, where it should be the other way around. And he linked me something to Wikipedia, and I saw it, and it was like the migrations of hunter-gatherers. And then it was telling you about the different skin pigmentation. And straight away, it's like, okay, so yeah, Cheddar Man, you know, the classic hominid type that was found in Britain was black. And it's almost like this new wave of science, haplogroup science, is kind of really cuffed a link with the globalist sympathizers, which kind of discredits any notion of race and culture, because they just come and go so, you know, so frequently. It's like, well, what are you trying to preserve? What's the point?
Yeah, so, they're always using it politically. I think that Cheddar Man, where they gave him the black skin, it was because he had a certain part of his DNA code, which in white people produces freckles. In black people, it produces black skin, but in white people, it produces freckles. It doesn't mean that the white people are of black ancestry, because it produces freckles in them. And what they did, they made the Cheddar Man have black skin. I mean, it looks like, what's her name? What's the name of that communist woman? The Bangladeshi communist woman. I can't think of her name. The really annoying one who hates white people.
Yeah, I know who you mean. He's always on Twitter.
Yeah, and on Jeremy Vine. I've forgotten her name. Yeah. But yeah, Cheddar Man looks very, very similar to her.
Or something, is it?
I can't think. She has a white boyfriend.
Anyway. Yeah, no, she's playing her part in white genocide, no doubt.
All the ones that seem to most be against white people happen to have white partners.
Something odd going on. Or the ones that are kind of culturally appropriating without knowing it. It's almost like they've got their own inner complex.
A study by Cura et al. 2014, based on cranial and genetic characteristics, suggests a northeastern Asian or Arctic origin for the Ainu people. Thus, despite the Ainu having morphological similarities to Caucasoid populations, the Ainu are essentially of North Asiatic origin. Genetic evidence supports a relation with Arctic populations such as the Chukchi people. So that what they're saying there is, well, genetically they're similar, but they don't look anything like them. But genetically they're similar, so they must be close to these people, even though they look nothing like them. I mean, that's a very strange one. I mean, you can say the opposite of that, and you can say, well, if you have a mixed race child genetically, they're not very similar to their parents at all, yet they are descended from them.
Somewhere in the middle, right?
Yeah. A study by Omoto has shown that the Ainu are more related to other East Asian groups, previously mentioned as Mongoloid, than to Western Eurasian groups, formerly termed as Caucasian, on the basis of fingerprints and dental morphology. So they're saying you can even tell the difference between races just by the fingerprints. But it's just a social construct, of course. Just a social construct, of course.
That's quite fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they can tell here from teeth as well, dental morphology. And again, you can see that they're politically correcting things already. Mongoloid has now become East Asian. Rather than referring to a physical type, they've changed it to refer to geography.
Yeah, definitely. Because that is kind of... it can adapt and change easily. There's nothing specific.
Yeah, and the same with Caucasian. I mean, even though Caucasian comes from the Caucasus, we know that it means a specific biological type, and yet they're now referring to Western Eurasian. So a geographical term instead of an ethnic term. A study published in the scientific journal Nature by Genam et al. 2015, using genome-wide SNP data comparison, found that a noteworthy amount of Ainu carry gene alleles associated with facial features which are commonly found among Europeans but are absent from Japanese people and other East Asians. But these alleles are not found in all tested Ainu samples. These alleles are the reason for their pseudo-Caucasian appearance, and it is suggested that they arrived from Paleolithic Siberia. So once again, they found evidence that shows that somewhere in their past ancestry there were white people there, and they have to make up an excuse for it having come from somewhere else. So they say Paleolithic Siberia.
Yeah, I think having conversation with, going back on the subject about these guys that really pushed the haplogroup narratives, it's almost like they see the mixings, but they don't have a general kind of path or route, you know, to set in stone. So they just kind of assume that everyone comes from the same branch, rather than mixings happened along the way And then, you know, they would claim that there is no kind of pure strain of, you know, of Aryan, a white person today, compared to, say, 2,000 years ago, for example, because they'll say there'd be so many different mixings gone on. But those mixings, they can't pinpoint when it happened. They just assume that it's just always been going off.
Well, tradition prevented it and culture prevented it. In the Book of the Danes, which is from the 10th century, and it was written by a Danish monk, Saxo Grammaticus, I think his name is. And what he's talking about there is the Danish history and the folk tales that the bards would talk about. And one of the folk tales is about somebody marrying out of their caste. And she marries somebody who is beneath her. And the offspring is against the person that was above the woman that got married. And it says, and that is always the way. The bastard offspring will always hate the person that's from the upper caste because they married down, they married lower down. Mm. And they'll always be closer to the person that was lower down the caste because they will resent that fact for their whole life. They will resent the fact that they could have been born in a higher caste than they actually were if it hadn't been for their father's indiscretion, as it were. And that's 1,000 years ago that goes back to. So that would have been a very, very strong cultural tradition, not to marry out of your caste, not to marry beneath your caste. And it's like it's a moral of the story, like one of Aesop's fables or something. Mm-hmm. And that would have been the same throughout, because we can see it in the Bible. It says, do not give your daughters to the sons of a strange god. Do not give your sons to the daughters of a strange god. Do not marry strange flesh. Do not have anything to do with strange flesh. And we know that the Levites used to marry the Levites as well, didn't they? They had a strong caste system, even within Israel.
Well, that's it. A lot of people argue that there's no such thing as, nothing against interracial kind of mixings in the New Testament, for example. Everyone's kind of, the old laws are done away with. But there's a lot of instances in the New Testament where it talks about, you know, fornication, which does include going after strange flesh within that state of, you know, sexual immorality. And there's also parts in Revelation, the Book of Jude especially is kind of quite blatant on that, and going after the way of Balaam, which was, where I think the Israelites were encouraged to marry outside of their own tribe in order to weaken them. And also the churches, the message to the seven churches at the end, I think about four out of the seven were kind of warned about fornication as being one of the main things. And there was another thing about fornication. So there's a common theme in the New Testament, really, about fornication. And I can't really think that it has much to do with, you know, sex outside of marriage. Moreover, kind of tainting the holy seed, which is linked to the covenants.
Well, it does make it quite clear, doesn't it? I think right the way through the Bible that it's against that. And when you look at fornication, what it means is unlawful sex. And what is unlawful sex? Well, it's sex that is outside of marriage. So what is a lawful marriage? And it tells you that right at the beginning, when Adam, or when God pulls Eve from Adam's rib, and he says, this will be his wife, and it's bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and the two shall become one. So a lawful marriage is somebody with the same bone structure, bone of my bones, and the same flesh, mm-hmm. flesh of my flesh. And that's the standard for lawful marriage. So anything that's outside of that is unlawful marriage, and it's therefore fornication. And they weren't handing over wedding rings and contracts. You know, who you were having sex with is who you were married to. And whether that was a lawful marriage or not, it depended on whether they were part of the same race. And also, obviously, you couldn't have adultery, as if they were already married to somebody else.
Well, only it was only couple of hundred years ago, if not more recently, where, you know, if someone slept with a man's daughter, that he basically, you know, was classed as defying her, and he was expected to marry her.
Yeah.
It was literally that, wasn't it? You took a virginity, then you owe her.
That was because they would have no other way to provide for themselves and for the child. They would need somebody to provide for them. Nobody else could marry them because somebody else had taken them. So the person that defiled them, they had to marry them to provide for them. That was the logic behind it. And I mean, that's what it says should happen in the Old Testament. And yeah, I think that still happens with some traveller societies today in the Caucasus. They still kidnap women and marry them. But I think that's more like there may be some courtship, and there's a little bit of romance involved in it as well. And it's seen as a little bit romantic to be kidnapped and, you know, taken. But that's their tradition, and they still have that as a tradition. Well, we've gone a little bit over, but we've finished at just about the right time, I think. So thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And until then, I hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.